Sebastian from Scope Global. Was a question for you, Robert, just around some of the discussion in the last weeks around the proposed discussion paper and the merger between the University of Adelaide and the University of South Australia. The discussion paper was reasonably silent on what that might mean for Flinders, and I just wondered if you had any comments on the perceived nature of the merger from a University of Flinders perspective.
That took like 45 seconds to get that right.
Well, that's one question that I just hadn't anticipated. No, we're really interested to see the merger talks going on. We think it's, you know, we will be interested observers. We will be interested to see how the negotiations go and proceed. We think they're well worth a discussion. We don't want to buy into it. We think that's a matter of the other two universities. But I think our performance over the last few years has been very strong. And we do have a sense that we are different and we want to maintain that difference. So I think we're comfortable with whatever the outcome is between those two universities.
Thank you. Well, we got off to the start we thought we might. Thank you.
Do you mind if I comment on that?
Yes, please.
I think that there is something fabulously university about the way that these two universities are conducting this. Think about any other organisation, two large organisations thinking about merging, running a process so open in a town that, insular isn't the word I mean at all. I come from Canberra, okay? But in a town in which this room would have every powerful business person in it, right? So there's an awful lot of talk everywhere about it. I think it is a real tribute and a real sign of the sorts of institutions they are that this process is being run in an open fashion. And an absolute example of what universities are about. We like evidence, we like fact, we like a really good debate.
I agree. Thank you. All right. Question from here. Thank you.
Natalie Hammond from the University of South Australia. Professor Rathjen, you used the example of Melbourne University achieving quite outstanding research results. And it's a question to everyone, actually, on the panel as to what you think prevents South Australia from achieving those results.
Look, it's a space I know pretty well because I was Deputy Vice-Chancellor of Research at Melbourne for several years. Melbourne was about 490. There's been about four Australian universities somewhere north of $350 million a year worth of research. One of the things that is not well understood in Australia is that we are unique in the world in the way that we choose to fund our universities because we don't fund research properly. If we get a research grant, we have to find about 50 cents in the dollar from somewhere else, student fees generally, to subsidise it. We do $165 million a year worth of research. We find about $80 million a year to cross-subsidise that. What that means is that in Australia, but not elsewhere in the world, your ability to do large amounts of research is determined by the size of your revenue base and how much you can afford to cross-subsidise. People ask me, why can't we build a Caltech here or a Harvard here? Huge universities, but with small student bases. The answer is, of course, that the research is not self-sufficient, and so we're stuck in a financial model that means if you don't have financial muscle, you can't do as much research. Melbourne has an annual budget of about $2.5 billion a year. That is why they're able to do $490 million worth of research. We sit at just south of $1 billion a year. We are able to do proportionally that amount of research. One of the questions I think South Australia needs to ask to think about is, if we believe that innovation and research are part of the raw material for new economy, how much do we need and where are we going to get it from?
If I can just, and Peter, well, we've discussed this before, one of the things, it's not actually the quantum, it's the output. You know, you can do $1 billion worth of research, but it's how you translate it, make it relevant, and it's that use case, which I referred to, which is critically important. So it's not an input-driven consideration, it's an output-driven one for me.
Thank you. All right, next question from this gentleman. Thank you.
Keith Hancock. I might say that I am actually an ex-vice-chancellor, but from more or less 40 years ago, and I'd like to acknowledge that the world in which the people at the table live is very different from the one that existed 40 years ago, much more challenging, much more difficult. And this is relevant to the question I want to ask. I was interested that David began by talking about Cardinal Newman's view of what a university was about, and what Newman had to say was more or less what we would have said when I was a vice chancellor back in the 1970s. Now, we would have said that it's a place for questioning, for challenging, for developing knowledge, developing thought, developing ideas. To those obligations, things like feeding innovations to industry, inventions that might have a commercial payoff, they were interesting. You didn't ignore them, but they are not central to the university. Now, the university is, seemed to me, these days to be very different. They have to take in a lot of international students in order to get their revenues up. Whether those students are interested in the sort of university that Cardinal Newman was interested in seems to me to be very doubtful. And I could elaborate, but I won't. But my question to any of the vice-chancellors or Katrina who choose to buy into it, is it really honest and realistic to pretend that today's universities are the universities of Cardinal Newman's world?
Fair point.
So I brought Newman into the conversation, but I brought him in on a very deliberate basis. I mean, Newman's idea of a university described the foundation of inquiry at the heart of universities. And my thesis is that that foundation has not been eroded. But what now we have to do is actually learn the relevance and the applicability, which is demanded by modern society. So the idea of a new university or the idea of a future university can't discount or put aside the foundation and the tradition of the existing institution. If we can't teach our learners how to think, we have no foundation for the production of graduates who are going to be productive.
Keith, I think I know a little bit about you. I was a Blackwood boy, and I used to do a lot of soccer and a lot of orienteering in that part of the world, and I reckon I must have been running around that campus when you were vice-chancellor of it. Well, another way of phrasing what I think David just said is that I don't think that the values of universities have changed very much at all across 1,000 years, but that the way in which we interpret those values in terms of social context, that has changed enormously. You picked on the innovation piece, but I don't think that's as challenging for the universities as the education piece. Back in those days, we still would have only been teaching a small proportion of school leavers. I went to Blackwood High School. I think we had 120 in matric, and I think 4 went on to University of Adelaide, and 2 or 3 went on to University of Flinders. That would have been pretty standard in those days. Nowadays, there'll be way over 50% of those school leavers are coming into universities. And it's not because we were doing anything wrong 30 or 40 years ago. It's because the nature of the economy has changed. If you don't get post-secondary education, you'll struggle to find a job, your kids won't do as well, you'll be less prosperous, you won't live as long. The data are pretty clear on all of those sorts of things. We have to find the right way to support what is a new social need, and that throws its own challenges into the universities. But the values that Newman talked about, I think they're still right at the core of the academics I talk to every day.
Hey, can I just add to that, that one of the interesting things that I've seen through my time in universities is a perception that there's been a move away, for example, blue sky basic research. And in fact, that has happened, not because that's where researchers want to go, but that's where the funding has gone, both from government and from industry. But there have always been the breadth of research going on in universities. I think what I've seen change is that researchers have come increasingly to understand that the questions that are raised, for example, by industry, by whatever's happening outside of the university, are just as interesting and challenging as those that they read about when they're looking at their current discipline journals. And there's been a genuine realisation among an increasing number that they have the capacity to contribute in an area that's still interesting and challenging as looking at those at the more fundamental questions might be. So we still have exactly that spread. The emphasis has changed a little bit. But in that sense, I think also universities haven't changed to the extent that sometimes they're perceived to have.
I can see one interesting change here, though, Keith. There are three scientists sitting at the front here as vice chancellors of the universities, and that's pretty unusual, I think. I don't think Newman was a scientist.
No.
It's worse, isn't it? Aren't we three biochemists?
David's a chemist.
Katrina, just one comment to that, Keith. I think you raise a really interesting point that goes to a number of both truths but also misconceptions. So you're absolutely right. Universities are different. We now educate around 40% of the what I call young person population. That's profoundly different from even when I was at university. I don't think that means for one minute we need to let go of those principles which David outlined in the first place. You talk to international students and the great flood of international students that have come to here from all around the region, and one of the things they absolutely love is that they are learning that learning is not rote, that learning is challenging and upending preconceptions and, in some cases, providing quite serious challenges to what they might have learnt if they were still home learning in a university in their home country. Some of the eye-opening you see in that is extraordinary, and that goes to exactly those sorts of principles. Of course, universities will have to shift as that sort of what I would describe as a democratisation of university education changes. But keep in mind, there's a US study which always makes me sit back in my chair. 99% of the jobs created post 9/11 require a university qualification. That's the US figures. There are very similar studies back here. So there are so many jobs now, and this is only going to get bigger, that genuinely need the kind of inquiring mind, the kind of ability to rethink really hard, to really seek truth, to really test and not fall back into your own preconceptions, the kind of thing that is about the foundation of the university. So I think the longer we're around, the more we need to work out how it is we work with those fundamental foundational truths at the same time as adapt to an enormously changing world all around us.
Thank you. Okay, we've got a question from the front. Thank you.
Hi, Bradley Abraham from the Royal Institution of Australia. I'm not going to talk about ATARs, but we've talked about secondary schooling and how that relates into the university sector. What relationship do universities have with the secondary, what is being taught in secondary schools and the students in secondary schools, and what relationship should universities have with what's being taught in the secondary schools and who's being taught in the secondary schools?
How long have we got, Brad? I had a breakfast with the school principals on Friday morning with a small group of new school principals, and one of the longest parts of our conversation was about ATAR. School principals and the school system have to deal with NAPLAN and ATAR as kind of boundary conditions to prescribe performance. And, you know, you can't go past the school, certainly in Adelaide, that hasn't got a billboard up that says what its average ATAR was for the attainment of its Year 12 students. And, you know, we honestly couldn't give a stuff about ATARs as vice-chancellors because we have evidence that shows that students who come in with no ATAR, with STAT, who go through a foundation program like Chris did in Wyala, can go on to be successful learners. It's a means to ration capped places because it gives you an ability to apply a cutoff. And when you apply a cutoff, you can say who has and who hasn't. And it's not a proxy for prediction of success. There are lots of measures that we can put in place as institutions where we can instill the ability to learn to make people successful. What relationship should we have with secondary schools? I think we're the gatekeepers for quality control in education because we produce the teachers. The standards that we should hold ourselves to in the production, again, the outcomes for our teachers are really important. So much fixation on the input side at the moment, even in the national debate. And if we can move to a situation where we can get decent prerequisites in place for programs, where we can actually make sure that prerequisites are mapped to outcomes and relevance in the education we provide the students, I think then we can drive not only higher standards in our graduates, but also as we produce more teachers who are held to a higher esteem in community.
Peter?
It puzzles me that we like to compartmentalise our education system so much. We somehow pretend that primary school is different from high school is different from TAFE, is different from a bachelor's degree, is different from a PhD. But in fact, the whole thing is a system which exists to help young people realise their talent and to express their creativity. If you go to America, they don't really talk about all these bits and pieces. They talk about K to 20. That's what they think is the education system. I think we're increasingly of a view that it's K, kindergarten, to death, because people are going to have to keep coming back through to re-educate themselves. We need a much more joined-up view of what it means to have an education system in this state and in this country than we do at the moment. And we've got to stop setting up barriers between each of those different compartments. The ATAR is fascinating. Our greatest concern with the ATAR is that young people are choosing their subjects to maximise their ATAR rather than choosing their subjects in the interest of their own further careers. We find that they're coming to university not properly prepared because they've done subjects which give them a few extra marks. Next year, we're going to pilot a scheme with a basket of South Australian schools which will make conditional offers to students at the end of Year 11, saying you can come to the University of Adelaide with a reasonable ATAR, but we want you to choose the subjects in matric that best set you up for what it is that you're going to do. I will be very interested to see what the response is to that pilot, because I think it might signal the end of some of the untoward consequences that we're currently seeing from the school system.
Thank you. Robert?
I was just going to add that it's not just the school system, it's the TAFE as well, the vet sector, that where integration can be closer and has been getting closer over the past few years.
So I'm loving the fact that the person who runs the most intelligent science TV channel asks the most tabloid question. You will have read a whole lot of rubbish in the papers about ATARs in the last couple of days. Remember that less than half the students who start at universities now come in on ATARs. So I couldn't help but echo what David said in the first place. It couldn't give a stuff is a very good attitude. There are so many other ways of measuring. Let me tell you a very brief story, however, about connections between schools and universities that tells you a bit more about the really responsible position universities take. There's a university in Victoria called Deakin University. If you sit up on the top floor of their city building, you can see Geelong Grammar. So one of the most privileged schools in the state. The suburb next to Geelong Grammar is one of the poorest suburbs in the whole of Victoria. There was a high school in that suburb that had never had a child in university. Deakin University took the proactive step to send their lecturers into that school really early on, from really junior levels all the way up to getting towards year 12. Took them quite some time to get kids even going through year 12. A couple of years ago, they graduated their first and second kids out of that school from the most underprivileged suburb in the whole of Victoria. And the amount of pride in the families and the faces of those kids who graduated from a profoundly underprivileged school, that was an act of extraordinary vision from a university. Keep in mind, those things cost money. When universities have to send people into schools, they have to find some way of paying for that. And there's already been some comment about funding rigidities. It is very hard for universities to be able to do that when things like the Higher Education Participation Program has been chopped and the funding freeze we're currently are labouring under.
Thank you. Okay, I believe I have a question from this side. Yep. Yes, you're on.
Hi, Michelle Nardelli from the University of South Australia. My question's related to international students, and I think it's wonderful that we have so many fantastic international students in South Australia, but I'm wondering how long we can rely on the international market for students, given that some of the countries we draw them from are developing very rapidly, but also that technologies are developing very rapidly, and maybe people won't be going to university in the same way that we thought they would in the past. It feels like we rely on that income quite strongly.
Who wants to take that? Do you want me to start? I think it's sort of strange that we talk about reliance on international students. Australian universities made a very conscious choice to start educating the children of the region decades and decades ago. Look around the Pacific, and the cabinet of most governments, most business people, will have been educated in an Australian university. That is an extraordinary contribution to regional stability, just to start with. Yep, we have lots of international students. Yes, universities are not in a position where they have an infinite choice in terms of sources of revenue, but I think this conversation gets tipped strangely on its head. I also think we need to think really clearly about the contribution that those students make when they come here. Those students can go anywhere they like. Australia has just been predicted to overtake the UK in terms of our attractiveness to international students. It is a source of real pride, and it should be a source of real pride, that we are world class and students want to come here because we're really good. And we're matching it with the UK and the US, much bigger markets. So I find the way this question gets asked strange sometimes, but I'm sure my colleagues will have different views.
I might just add that I don't see the demand for education coming to a country like Australia to dry up in the near future. It can dry up if there are political decisions made in some of the overseas countries, and we know that they are developing their education system and improving it. But we do have such a fantastic reputation. We've got now an established number of generations, the number of international students who come whose parent was studied here. I think they still seek to have an immersive English language experience, which they're unlikely to get. So I'm quite optimistic in the certainly the short term, probably the medium term, and it may get a lot harder beyond that, but I'm optimistic.
I reckon it's an important question for Adelaide. I've been very impressed coming back to this city after 12 years. It's a better Adelaide than the city I left, and I think there are two key reasons for it. I think what's been done around the Torrens here is absolutely world class. It's quite wonderful. But the other thing is that while I've been away, Adelaide has become a city of young people, whereas it didn't used to be. The mall used to be almost dangerous at night, and now it's full of young people, bars, restaurants and those things. And I think it's the international students that have made the biggest difference there. They live in the city and they bring a vitality to the city that we haven't seen before. Oddly enough, South Australia underperforms here. We attract less than 6% of the international students across the country, and there's more that we could do if we wanted to. People have been preaching the demise of people attending university ever since I've been there. Every time there's something on the internet or a MOOC or something like that, it's evidence that universities are going to decline and students won't come. For about 20 years, people have been preaching the collapse of the international student markets, but that hasn't come, at least come yet. In fact, through those 20 years, more people across the world are attending more universities than they have before. And it's, of course, because the university experience far transcends mere lectures and tutorials. It's about interactions with peers, interactions with other people. The big problem, of course, is we all know we're far too dependent on China. But it doesn't mean that there aren't a number of other countries across the world that are about to develop very large middle classes. Some of South America, Indonesia is another very key one in the space. And if you were in England, you'd be looking a lot into Africa, which is a place that Australian universities don't really go. I think more balance is going to be important, but I think the mission we have of enriching ourselves socially and showing respect for diversity within our institutions transcends all of those arguments. I hope we can continue to play in that space.
I'm not going to repeat any of the points that have been made, but I think I'll echo what Katrina said. This is not about reliance. This is about the production of choice, or the offering of choice in what is a global market. And university students, international students, choose the product, which is the program they're going to study. They choose the place that they're going to study in. They choose the institution, and then they look at the price. And Australian education, higher education for international students, is not cheap, which means that the other determinants, which is about the universities, what they offer and where they offer it, is actually a key determinant in that global piece. And it's something that we've worked very hard to be competitive at in terms of what we offer. But there's not a question of reliance. While it's a big export industry, and certainly we will surpass wine probably in the next 12 months as being the most influential export industry in South Australia, it's something that we have to preserve and diversify, but it's not something that we need to think of as a reliance that keeps the doors open to the institutions.
Thank you. I think we have time for one or two more questions. I've got someone. Yep. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you. Andrew Abel, University of Adelaide, an interested observer and also a graduate of Blackwood High School.
His brother Dick was my best friend in first year.
My observation is we have a problem of relevance in getting into the profile. If you talk to 100 politicians, universities wouldn't be on their list of things of significance. If you talk to 1,000 people on the street, no one would know what Universities of Australia is. I've been in the sector for many years and I don't know what Universities Australia is or does. So I'm just wondering how we can get universities onto the agenda in a more public way.
Excellent question.
Perhaps I can have a first go at that one, Andy. The politicians will be interested in universities when there are votes in universities. There's a dead straight line that can be drawn between those two, and so it tells us that across the community we don't have the profile that we think we should justify. And one of the questions I think we have to ask ourselves as a sector is, why is that? If we're as important as we think we are, why is our argument not being heard? Why is our voice not being heard? I don't want to give you an answer to that, but I want to go to a comment that Katrina made about the courage that it's taken to open up a public debate about what the future of the South Australian higher education system might look like. I do not know what the outcome of that debate is going to be. There may be structural change, there may not be structural change. But I do believe that there will be a much greater awareness across the South Australian community of why it has universities, how its universities are going, whether it's getting enough from its universities, whether its universities could be doing more to support South Australia to become a better community and a stronger economy. And if that's the only outcome of that debate, it will be a wonderful outcome for this group of people. That's the kind of thing, genuine understanding, that we must have faith will translate into political support, not a one-hit silver bullet solution that says the politicians suddenly become interested, but a concerted campaign to explain to people why we, as much as anyone, hold the future of our society in our hands and therefore must be listened to, must be respected, must be argued with if that's what it's take, but have to be understood.
I guess in my 6 years, like Pete, 7 years as a VC, the number of vice chancellors who've seen new prime ministers and new ministers for education, we make reference to it on an annual basis at these events. We were promised masterful inaction by Tony Abbott when he was leader of the opposition before he came into power, which was 4 years ago? At the time, the universities kind of went, that's okay, because that's the way in which the sector tends to be regarded. When we're doing a good job, we're left alone, and then when we're deemed to be lazy or overly affluent or in some ways fiscally responsible and putting away margins for investment in infrastructure, we're told we're overfunded. And then when cuts come around, we're able to point out the actual impact we have in society. It's not just about the intellectual capital. It's about the fact that 80% of parents want their children to attend university. And if there's not going to be a university there to actually provide that education, to provide those the training for those jobs of the future, the post 9/11 jobs that nearly 100% of everything that's created requires on that type of education, then people become concerned. So when politicians are not looking at us, I think we're doing a good job. When politicians are looking at us, it's either to take money away from us or because they're planning to take money away from us. And when we have to go out and make a campaign which has a hashtag Stop Uni Cuts, in a society which is supposed to be transitioning towards a knowledge economy, it makes me question the values of Australian society. I've seen it in Europe, but I saw it 10 years ago during a global financial crisis where the impetus was about scrambling around to save money no matter what. But what wasn't cut were education budgets. The investments were put back in. You look at Canada, who just decided to make one of the biggest investments in research globally of any nation, are looking to the future. So if politicians are disinterested, that's fine. The motivations for their interest cause me concern. When we get to report on our successes, they're happy to turn up and actually open the institutes or the relationships that we have with the multinationals. And that's fine too, because we're in the business of education. We're not in the business of politics. But when we find ourselves defending the ethos, the actual existence of institutions, then as a society we have an issue.
So what I do every single day is defend universities and talk about the relevance that universities have to absolutely everyday life. So I suppose that means I'm doing a really terrible job at this stage. The reason I keep doing that job is I know in Australia, which is a strange country, we're not quite the same as the UK or quite the same as the US, where being really smart and really successful is absolutely tip-top. We're good at pulling people down or not quite seeing that someone really smart has an enormous contribution to make. I genuinely think that's shifting. I mean, call me a ridiculous optimist, but I really think it is shifting. I think part of the reason it's shifting is a comment that Peter made and a combination of all those comments. And partly that's because, as I said before, 40% of young people are now at university. The more people are at university, the more parents who aspire to have their kids go to university, the more politically relevant we become, and the more politically relevant you become, the more difficult it is for people who make the policies which direct the way universities operate and the funding streams. It just makes it harder for them to disregard you politically. And if you're disregarded politically, it's like living in a safe seat. You get nothing. You want to move to a marginal seat. Move your university to a marginal seat, all of a sudden it will become an awful lot more relevant. But universities day in, day out do things to demonstrate their relevance and their value. And I think there is actually genuinely in the community, not perhaps in the political class, a shift in feeling about the value of universities as people see more and are less frightened of universities. Let's face it, back in the old days when a very small proportion of the university of the community went to universities, some people felt they genuinely didn't belong there or they were for other people. That's increasingly just less and less the case, and I think that puts us in a stronger and stronger position to demonstrate our relevance because and our value because more and more people want to attend university. I don't know if that answers your question.
Thank you. I've just been given a signal. We're up to our very last question and we'll keep it brief. And before we close off, thank you for the last question.
Tim Cooper from Cooper's Brewery. As a former graduate of the University of Adelaide, I wish David and Peter all the best with their discussions about mergers of the two universities. My question is directed to Katrina. In terms of the concern about budget cuts, in the first term of the federal Liberal government, there was a lot of discussion about trying to get through the Senate liberalisation of university fees, and I believe all but one of the vice-chancellors were in agreement with that plan. Is it still on your agenda to, at the same time, oppose the cuts to university fees but also push the federal government into allowing liberalisation of the university fees?
Thank you. Lovely to have a brewer ask the hardest question. I am delighted to say I was not working at Universities Australia back in 2014, so my intimate knowledge of exactly what happened during that period is by hearsay like everybody else's. The reality is the deregulation of university fees is off the political agenda, so that means it's off the table. We're not going to waste our time concentrating on or giving attention to policy ideas that were on the table for a while and now firmly off the table. The thing that I think is most important for us as a sector right now is the fact that places and university funding for places has been frozen. So just before Christmas, the current government froze funding for university places, and that reverses what had been a pretty solid bipartisan commitment to expand the number of places, but to have an uncapped system. So that doesn't mean infinite forever and ever more, because demand had entirely normally sort of levelled off to about that 40% of young people. So quite nicely just sort of gone up, and then nice and flat. But a frozen system means that there is absolutely no, as you would think, no flexibility inside the system. So students are making the sorts of choices that students of my era made. I go to a university, I work out where I go because I get rationed into one. So it's completely irrational. It also means that universities in areas of high population growth or high skill shortage have no flexibility to grow. So it makes things unbelievably difficult. It also, because a freeze is a cut, because of the indexation arrangements, it means that universities are getting a bit less every single year. And this is enormously regressive and enormously problematic. So that's the big issue for us now.
I just want to build on that. I don't want anybody to walk away from here and think that there's a 40% participation rate in South Australia. 40% is the average national participation rate in higher education. South Australia's at 31, right? And the target was 40. And in the presence of a cap, we have no means to actually grow towards that target.
Okay. Well, thank you very much to the panel.